Welcome to this, the Tuesday edition of Closer Look. I'm Jim Burris.
And I'm Rose Scott.
In the year 1981, researchers were hard at work at the Atlanta-based CDC trying to understand why a series of rare cancers was infecting primarily gay men. It would take another year for the network health reporters to do those first stories on HIV.
Scientists at the National Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta.
Federal health officials consider it an epidemic, yet you rarely hear a thing about it.
Released the results of a study which shows that the lifestyle of some male homosexuals has triggered an epidemic.
A disease experts are now calling a national epidemic.
Researchers know of 413 people who have contracted the condition in the past year.
Patient Zero is the name Dr. Dritz and the medical detectives used to describe this man.
Now it's been detected in Haitian refugees. No one knows why. And in heavy drug users, especially in New York City. No one knows why. And in some people with hemophilia, a disease that prevents blood clotting so the patient needs frequent blood transfusions. Why?
How? Why did my son get this disease? And they said, well, we think this might be the tip of the iceberg. We think that all hemophiliacs might have been infected.
Well, Dr. Mary Guinan was one of the first scientists in America to identify the emerging AIDS cases as part of a larger epidemic of a new and deadly disease. Well, she's currently the dean of the School of Community Health Sciences at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and she's in Athens, Georgia today as part of UGA's annual State of Public Health Conference. But she's taking time to join us on the line now from WUGA in Athens. Dr. Guinan, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Delighted to be here.
If you will, let's go back to 1980, and I'm wondering, was there this sort of an aha moment when you and your CDC team members truly understood the potential of your new understanding here?
Well, prior to the 1981 MMWR, which is the CDC newsletter, which announced five cases of this disease, we had been receiving calls from around the nations from physician asking us if there was something new happening. Is there some new disease going on? Because they had a patient that had some kind of a compromised immune system, and they were developing different infections. And did we have any information? We used to share these phone calls among the group of people who worked in the Sexually Transmitted Diseases Division at CDC, because many of the patients were that people called about were gay men. And so we wondered if there was a new sexually transmitted disease coming and what it was. But what was frightening about it was this disease seemed to be a killer disease, which was much different from all our other sexually transmitted diseases, for which were not nearly so serious and most of which we had a treatment for that would cure it.
And Dr. Guinan, I have to ask, was this scary for you all, that there was something, this was something new, but it was a killer disease?
Yes, it was very scary. And a group of us who had been gathering the information went to our boss and said, something terrible is happening. People are dying. We know that something's going on here. And it appears right now to be just in gay men, but we have no idea what the extent is. And because it's in gay men, we're wondering if this is a sexually transmitted disease. So we finally were given by Dr. Michael Gottlieb at the University of California in Los Angeles. He sent us a manuscript of five cases. This is in 1981, of five cases of this new syndrome, and described them all and what they had. Two of them had died, and the other three had multiple different kinds of infections, and all five of them had a herpes virus infection. At that time, I was the herpes virus expert at CDC. They used to call me Dr. Herpes because I would be on either TV or the radio talking about herpes virus infection. And so they ask, when something is sent to the CDC to be published in their newsletter, the MMWR, which is a weekly newsletter. It has to pass through a series of people who know about the disease or have expertise in the disease. And since this disease, we had nobody with that kind of expertise, they asked me because all of the men had herpes virus, they asked me to review the manuscript and then decide whether it should be published. And so I reviewed it and then passed it on up. And to my boss at the time, Jim Curran, who wrote on my manuscript, Hot Stuff.
Mm. Mm. We've had Jim Curran in the studios on this issue and others. I want to ask you, you mentioned the nickname Dr. Herpes. I also read that you were nicknamed Dr. Condom and that you were better able to capture the media's attention over the herpes virus than you were about HIV in those days. Why do you think that was?
Well, HIV was a disease that, at least as we were seeing it at that time, herpes simplex virus, genital herpes infections. There are actually 8 herpes viruses. So this herpes virus that was sexually transmitted, it seemed to be occurring more in white people. And white people were outraged that they could get a sexually transmitted disease. And so they were demanding from the government information on why we were covering up this disease and what could be done about it. The media people at CDC were constantly being asked to speak, and I was on multiple shows. I was on things like Phil Donahue, mm-hmm. 60 Minutes, many, which I really didn't want to really do it because it was usually exaggerated that this is a incurable, deadly disease that was sweeping the nation when that actually wasn't the case. It was a handleable disease. It resolved by itself, but it recurred. But it didn't cause any other, and it could be sexually transmitted. So my reluctance then, when we found this disease that we eventually called AIDS, nobody wanted to hear about it because it wasn't in the middle class white folks that were very concerned about herpes virus infection.
Is that still the case today? Do you get the sense that maybe some of the conversations aren't being had because it's seen still maybe not as a white middle class male disease?
Well, I think that some of it is still there. I can tell you that if it's sexually transmitted, these are considered people who are not middle class people. People think that who gets sexually transmitted disease, it's only people who are not careful or who are uninformed, which is, of course, not the truth. But even now, for example, with other viruses, if they're transmitted by non-sexual means, people are very concerned about it, and everyone is concerned, and there is concern in the community about it. But when it turns out that the virus then, or the bacteria is sexually transmitted, people think, well, these people deserve what they get. You know, they're doing inappropriate things, and therefore they deserve what they get. And I'm afraid this is going to happen with Zika virus. Zika virus is being spread by mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. But now we know it's sexually transmitted. And that's much more dangerous from my point of view. We can actually kill the mosquitoes. We have an ability to control the mosquitoes. But we really don't have any ability to control sexual transmission of Zika virus. And so my concern is that once people get, like what happened in AIDS, mm-hmm. If people get it sexually, well, then they're not victims. They cause their own problems. But if you got it some other way, then we have a sympathetic voice for you.
And Dr. Guinan, I want to stay back to your early years of working in this area, because you were working for the CDC's Epidemic Intelligence Service, which sounds like some CSI for diseases. And this is in the 1970s, and you were also working in India to eradicate smallpox. So what was it about this experience that at all, did it change how you view medicine and how research was trying to develop, you know, defenses against these diseases that for some didn't know that we would ever be able to say, yes, we can eradicate smallpox?
Well, when I finished my training in medicine, I was undecided about what I was going to do, whether I was going to practice medicine in an academic setting or what I was going to do. And I read an article in a medical journal about this program, a worldwide program to eradicate smallpox. It would be, if it was successful, be the only time in the history since civilization began that a disease would be eradicated mm-hmm. by design of humans. And so I thought, my goodness, and it turns out that 165 nations, that's how many countries there were in the world then, 165 had agreed to eliminate smallpox, to work together. And it was, this program was led by the World Health Organization in Geneva. And I found out, so I said, I want to be part of this program. And I found out that the agency who was sending people to the smallpox eradication program in America, every country had a liaison with the World Health Organization. And our liaison in the United States was the Centers for Disease Control. So I talk with people who might know about this and say, how could I possibly get a job at CDC? And they said, I met someone who said, well, they have this Epidemic Intelligence Service. Why don't you apply to that? And what this was a two-year training program where you learn to investigate, identify, and control epidemics. Yes, and it's what we call medical detectives, training us to be medical detectives or epidemiologists. So that's the technical word for us is epidemiologists. So I was accepted into the program. I was there were 39 physicians in my class, and I was the only only woman. So it was unusual to have a woman in the program, mm-hmm. and I then was doing my job, and in the book, the first story is about my first outbreak investigation, which happened in a hospital, a military hospital, and what I had to do, go to a military hospital and help find what was causing this outbreak of sepsis in mostly generals or high officials. It was successful. We found the problem and fixed it. So I found that my training had been, I gave me some confidence that I could then go out and investigate. Mm-hmm. And they were asking for volunteers for the smallpox eradication program in India. So I volunteered and was accepted into the program in India. I thought, this is the most incredible job my dream job, that I would go out and actually try and prevent smallpox. And I was sent to India. India was a high priority at that point. It was in 1974 mm-hmm. and 75. And so I was sent to Geneva first, then trained, and then went to Uttar Pradesh, India, which is very remote part of in India. It's up near Nepal, where it was 99% illiteracy rate. And the people, I had never seen a foreigner before. So how it worked was we were given a jeep, uh-huh. a driver, and a paramedical assistant. And we went from village to village searching for smallpox cases. That was called surveillance and control, mm-hmm. finding the person with smallpox, quarantining the patient, and then in vaccinating the people in a 10-mile radius of the case.
Well, Dr. Guyton, let me jump in here for a second because we just have a little bit of time, but I want to get this question in because in all your experiences and what you've been involved in, do you think in your lifetime, in my lifetime, are you confident that there will be a cure for HIV?
I'm hopeful, but not confident.
Okay.
I do think that the answer is to get a vaccine. It's mm-hmm. very difficult because the HIV is constantly mutating. And even though we have drugs now that are very, very effective, they don't cure.
And
it's a lifelong pattern. So I do believe that we need to invest more in finding a vaccine that will prevent disease, and we could actually eradicate HIV from the world.
Dr. Mary Guinan, a keynote speaker at today's State of Public Health. She joined us from the studios of WAGA in Athens, Georgia. Dr. Guinan, thank you so much for taking the time this afternoon. Thank you.
You're welcome.
For the past 26 years, Jerusalem House has, quote, met people where they are. Now, the nonprofit is Atlanta's oldest and largest provider of permanent housing for local low-income and homeless people affected by HIV/AIDS. And it operates on the premise that housing is healthcare.
That's because the majority of those with HIV/AIDS see their conditions improve when they have access to stable housing. But all housing is not created equally, and that's what makes Jerusalem House a bit different. Their residents have their own homes, private apartments big enough to house not just them, but also their families. And recently, I visited to take a look.
This little area here, from what I was told, was kind of a gully, I guess, that just...
Janice Harris-Corey is Director of Housing and Residential Services at Jerusalem House.
But this is a memorial area that was created by the friends of Philip Mason Houseworth.
Houseworth was a landscape architect who worked for the organization's founding board member. Janice says when he was diagnosed with AIDS, his life changed.
His family and some friends stuck by him, but a lot of people didn't.
That inspired that founding board member, Evelyn Oldman, to do something for those living with HIV. Thus, Jerusalem House was eventually born. And this courtyard is a tribute to Houseworth's struggle.
So this area was done by his friends and created as a little memorial area.
It's a peaceful, manicured assortment of green plants and grasses connected by brick walkways and punctuated with benches for reflection. And there's a small memorial for someone who succumbed to AIDS in the early days of Jerusalem House. Those early days are when Janice saw lots of residents die.
When I first started working here, it was every 3 months. It was every 3 months at least, but that was like clockwork.
Advances in medications have greatly changed what it means to be HIV positive. People can and do live full and normal lives. For Janice, that means years now pass between deaths here at Jerusalem House, not months. But she's clear, AIDS still kills.
But we just had a gentleman who died the end of June. He's 38 years old, and he lost his battle. He just got something, and it was very quick. He came back from a trip and got sick and just never came back from it.
It could be difficult to view that man's journey as a success story. For those here at Jerusalem House, his story is one of grand success. Even if for a short while, he got better, and he also got to live his dream. But Shandora Lane's life was anything but a dream. When the mother and her young son arrived at Jerusalem House, she was addicted to drugs. The criminal activity she resorted to in order to pay her dealer also left Shandora with multiple felonies. It's in this sunroom of an expansive home in one of Atlanta's old grand neighborhoods that I meet 52-year-old Shandora Lane.
Just a few basic questions.
Jerusalem House doesn't make public the home's location. And if you're like me, you've driven past it hundreds of times and never even noticed. Shandora wears a white, ruffled blouse and black pants, and her smile is as big as the early morning sunshine is bright.
In the times where you were in active addiction and your son was there, tell me what that situation was like.
It was scary, but fortunately I had a mother that really cared, and she took my son before I would allow him to fall into that pattern with me.
What do you think made you fall into that pattern yourself?
First of all, I honestly pondered over this for the last 8 years of my recovery. And the only thing that I see what made me fall into an active addiction was wanting to be accepted. I truly did not accept myself. And then after being found out I was HIV positive, it's just like I didn't care anymore. When I found out that I was HIV positive, it was back in 1989, 26 years ago. I was in prison, going through diagnostic testing, and at that point, the only thing they told me that they had a pill called AZT, and that would keep me alive. So I really didn't further the education in it. I just thought, I take this pill, one day I'm just going to die, and that was it.
Shandora didn't take care of herself, didn't stay on top of her doctor's appointments, neglected medication. Eventually, Shandora found herself in the hospital with tuberculosis.
I was so sick. I was walking around with 104 temperature. My niece got me to the hospital. I had a T-cell of 77.
A T-cell is what triggers an immune response if there's an abnormal bacterium or a virus in your bloodstream. Counts in HIV-negative adults are as high as 1,600. Shandora's count of 77 meant her body just didn't have much fight left in it.
My mother started making funeral arrangements.
Shandora's faith meant she didn't believe someone else's blood should be put into her body. So she says doctors gave her what she calls a synthetic blood transfusion.
That was an act of God. I don't care what no one say. I believe that. I'm convinced of that. That is my story.
30 days later, Shandora simply got up, started to walk, and soon left the hospital.
I stayed for about 3 more months. And then I used again. Then I stayed sober again. Then I had my son, 1999. And even with that, you know, my addiction overpowered me.
That cycle of getting on and falling off the proverbial wagon continued for years until 2008.
And what brought me to recovery, and I thank my mother so much, she pressed charges against me for writing checks. And that's the only reason I'm sitting here today, 8 years clean.
Shandora is now working to become a substance abuse counselor. She credits Jerusalem House. She also gives the nonprofit credit for helping her stay on top of her health. Instead of 20 pills a day, she now takes 2.
Because of Jerusalem House, I have confidence, I have stability. You know, most importantly, I have hope.
You can have all of the medications in the world and provide those to people, but if they don't have stability around housing, it's very difficult to be medically compliant.
That's Jerusalem House Executive Director Charlie Frew. He says Shandora's story of addiction, criminal convictions, and homelessness is common when someone crosses his door. Charlie says for a person to grow and get better, stable housing has to be included in the picture.
If someone's living on the street, they are typically thinking about where are they going to sleep that night, how are they going to eat. When someone has children, there's that added issue. We know that housing is pretty much the foundation of helping a person survive.
Even as fewer people are dying of HIV, Charlie says demand for Jerusalem House's services continues to increase. In the 8 years he's been here, he's watched it grow from 67 housing units and 101 residents to about 3 times that many now. But no matter how many residents or how they got here, Charlie says the end goal remains the same.
At the end of the day, the best thing in the world that can happen is someone gaining the ability to move out to independent, sustainable living with a life, with a career, with their families at their sides.
Then call Shandora Lane's story one of success. The courtyard where we began our conversation is where Shandora and I say our goodbyes. And soon, Shandora will say goodbye to her apartment here at Jerusalem House. She's about to move out and live independently.
It's just, I cannot give this place enough credit. Oh my God, 5 stars is not enough. It's not enough, Jim, for the opportunity. And yes, Jerusalem House had offered us housing. It offers stability, but we have work to do as an individual. That means taking our meds,
getting to appointments, doing what we need to do to take care of ourselves. They built the foundation for us. We need to take full advantage of what we have here. You know, I'm telling you, and be honest, Jerusalem House can make you complacent and make you don't want to go. You're just safe, you know. And I mean, my heart aching now, I want to cry. Because okay. I don't want to go. But I know I have to go because someone needs the opportunity that I've been given. But I hope the person take full advantage of what this program have to offer. Because it's everything you need. Everything you need to get another start in life.
Now, Jerusalem House is expanding to accommodate more than 2,700 additional people over the next 2 years. And it's reporting like that that we are committed to bringing you right here on Closer Look.
And we want to give you a quick update on Shandora, who you heard in the piece. She is now living on her own, doing well. In an emailed note, I'm told her transition from the family program to the adult program was seamless and easy. She said the nonprofit has been a blessing in her life. She feels very fortunate and says her new home is a wonderful place to be.
You know, Jim, it's not complete yet, but the new home for the Atlanta Falcons is right on schedule for its completion date.
Yeah, the Mercedes-Benz Stadium is located near the city's West End, an area that Falcons owner Arthur Blank has promised he'll infuse economic opportunity into. Now, owning the Atlanta Falcons is just one of many businesses that make up Arthur Blank's portfolio. In fact, earlier this year, Arthur Blank officially relinquished day-to-day operations of those ventures to someone else.
That someone else was Steve Cannon, who took over as chief executive officer of Arthur Blank's for-profit businesses. Now, there's a connection to Cannon and the corporate name on the stadium. So when we spoke, I asked the New Jersey native how he landed in Atlanta.
I took a wrong turn somewhere, Rose. No, Actually, kind of a circuitous route. I was part of Mercedes-Benz. I was the CEO of Mercedes-Benz North America. And we decided to relocate our headquarters. Mm-hmm. We loved the environment here in Atlanta. And after a national search for a new headquarters location, we selected Atlanta. As I made that move down here, connected with Arthur, and there was this values match. And then I heard at a similar time that he was looking to step back into a chairman role, and mm-hmm. he was making a search for a CEO. And when I found about that, I just got intrigued. So I made a phone call, and 6 months later, I'm working for Arthur Blank.
What was your perception of Atlanta before moving down here? Had you been here before?
I had been here before. I mean, I was living near here in Alabama during the Olympics, and that was obviously a big inflection point for Atlanta. And generally, we were thrilled as Mercedes about everything that we saw, minus the traffic, but dynamic business environment, incredible infrastructure, sort of business political environment that was all about finding ways to make businesses thrive. So that environment was kind of the great mix that we decided as Mercedes made sense for us.
So this arm of Arthur Blank, this Arthur Blank family of businesses, it's not a nonprofit. You oversee everything that's all Arthur Blank. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. I mean, not to be confused with the foundation.
Sure.
The foundation is the nonprofit, and I'm not. I don't run that. All of his for-profit businesses, the ones that I just described, is my responsibility.
So let's talk about those responsibilities, because this is Arthur Blank. Obviously, he's a billionaire. He's a man who knows what it takes to make a lot of money. He knows what ventures work. Now you're responsible for that. That's a lot of pressure.
It's good pressure. I mean, what I love about Arthur and the team and the vision is this is a group that is absolutely swinging for the fences. Excuse the baseball metaphor and a football franchise, but planting Mercedes-Benz Stadium in downtown Atlanta, the group had a vision that said, we are not going to just create the next best stadium, copy-paste what the last group did and make it incrementally better. They said, how are we as a group going to redefine the fan experience in every way? And that's been sort of our charge. So it's actually invigorating. It's exciting to be part of a group and part of a vision that's really looking to do big things.
You mentioned that the nonprofit is separate. But part of that mission for the nonprofit is building the community. And we both know the community around the stadium has one that's been suppressed for a number of years. So on the business side, do you have to work with the nonprofit side at all to get these initiatives going for that community, for the West End?
We absolutely work together with the foundation. The foundation is our enabling arm, and it does incredible work across a very broad spectrum. But each and every one of our businesses has a nonprofit focus, a give-back focus. So for Atlanta United, it's soccer in the streets. It's bringing soccer into the West Side, into other parts where kids don't have that, using sport as a vehicle for social change. Same approach, fighting, getting active and fighting childhood obesity for the Falcons. So giving back is one of those core values that Arthur has infused with all of his companies, starting with Home Depot. It's no different from us. So it's not just foundation and the for-profit side. It's all of us kind of working together to have an impact.
And as a CEO, how much of your relationship with Mr. Blank is going to be important in making sure on the business side that you're developing those core values, but also at the same time, it is Arthur Blank. So if anything goes wrong, it's his name attached to it. They don't say, oh, it must have been the CEO, Steve Cannon, which is why this venture didn't work.
100%. And that's why when I got to know Arthur and when he was vetting, obviously, other candidates, the most important thing was the value system. And do we operate according to the same set of values? And now that he knows that and understands that, he knows that we might do things slightly differently to get from point A to point B. But if the values are perfectly aligned, he can trust that I'm going to be doing the right things for his brand and for his businesses.
Let's talk about those values, because there's this whole notion of putting people first. There's include everyone, lead by example. So let's start with putting people first. What does that mean as part of your mission statement?
Well, look, leadership is a people business, and you got to understand the strengths of your people. I believe that the best way to lead in any situation is from the front, not sitting in a corner office as the CEO and waiting for people to come to me. It's about how can I project myself, get involved with the team, hear all of their inputs, and ultimately bringing them together creates a better product, and that creates this inclusive work environment that just frankly makes a better place for people to show up every day.
Let's talk about lessons learned, because are you bringing some lessons learned from your time at Mercedes-Benz into this new role, and what were they? And be frank, what didn't work when you were with Mercedes-Benz in that capacity?
I've honestly found more similarities than differences as I've made the move from Mercedes-Benz to the Arthur Blank group of companies. One of the biggest challenges that we have in front of us right now is to, number one, complete the stadium, but then to fill that with 4,000 people that share those values, that are there to create an incredible fan experience. That's not easy stuff.
You're talking about employees.
Yeah, employees. And now, so one of my biggest jobs is going to be to help create a system, a culture, that for everybody that is connected to Arthur Blank Companies and to that stadium, that they are all about delivering a world best fan experience. That is not easy stuff to do. That was my mission at Mercedes-Benz. It was all about creating a customer experience that lived up to the tagline, the best or nothing. So I feel like I'm doing a lot of the same things, and instead of it being at a dealership for Mercedes-Benz, it's going to be at Mercedes-Benz Stadium in downtown Atlanta.
Is that your top priority? Because Arthur Blank has a lot of businesses, as you mentioned. So is that your priority right now, is creating this fan experience with the stadium?
Stadium and fan experience are top priorities. Look, that's the biggest single investment. That's the crown jewel, if you will, of the portfolio of businesses. They're all important, but the Falcons, you know, is the 800-pound gorilla, and we are now building a stadium that's going to take the businesses to kind of a new level. And look, anybody with enough money can build an incredible stadium, but it's about how you populate that with people whose sole mission is to kind of amaze and delight fans when they come in and spend their money and spend 4 or 5 hours of their day together with their families inside of our venue. We take that like a trust that we have something to deliver on.
Inside that venue, you have workers, you have employees, and whether they're from those who are taking tickets at the gate or from executives who are selling the suites, what's your role in ensuring that from a quality of life standpoint, everyone is being paid what they should and it's fair?
Absolutely, a fair wage is sort of the entry point to the game. But if you talk to people, it's not just about money, it's about purpose. And if we can create an environment, a culture, and a team that feels like they've got a purpose, and it's about connecting with people and sort of making their day, that is really, really important. So yes, couldn't agree with you more. Fair wage, that's the starting point. But there's lots of disengaged people out there that work for companies that get paid very decent wages. So it goes beyond pay, and it goes to culture, and it goes to values.
That being the case, is there a template or a blueprint for you that you've looked at, another model from any other entity or industry that you use?
There's not workbooks or templates. There's compasses and not maps. And generally, my compass is most informed by culture eats strategy for breakfast. And the biggest thing, that's a saying that a business guru from the 50s bought out, and I love it.
I was going to ask you, was that your own personal philosophy, or are you borrowing that from somebody?
Oh, I borrowed it, but it's mine. And I live it. And at the end of the day, what do leaders do? They create cultures. And if you create a phenomenal, vibrant culture inside of an organization, you can be pretty sure that the outcome that you're looking for is more likely to take place if you've invested in people, you empower people, you give those people a vision and a purpose. So I think my number one job across the entire portfolio of businesses is to create a culture that'll allow great things to happen. So whether that's a stadium or a golf retail shop or an Atlanta United fan experience.
That's an answer that a lot of CEOs may give. You've been in this for a while, so you know we've heard famous CEOs make the same pledges. But how do you ensure that? And does that begin with you appointing other people to buy into that vision, which is, of course, coming from Arthur Blank's vision?
Right. It starts with a leadership team that's aligned behind that, and that alignment inside of organizations does not take place in a vacuum. You know, in the same way that Coach Quinn creates alignment inside of his team with the Falcons, he calls it a brotherhood. These folks that start to believe, and as they believe and all buy into that same mission and vision, great things start to happen.
But he also needs a pretty good defensive line too.
He does. I mean, you obviously need the raw materials, but as you know, raw materials alone do not a winning team make. You need something beyond that. And that's where purpose and mission and values come in. And, you know, and again, for me, it's going to be about creating that environment where people can thrive.
I want to focus on people for a moment. And there's another initiative that you're involved in. That's the Johnny Mac Soldier Fund. What's the backstory here, Steve?
Backstory is I come from a military background. Mm-hmm. I went to West Point and that's an incredible shared experience. And I then served my country, and I was on had my 5-year experience, which was great. And I've sort of belonged to a band of brothers and sisters that have that common experience. A good friend of mine, John McHugh, was a full colonel over in Afghanistan, was killed by a suicide bomber in 2010, left behind a wife and 5 beautiful children. And what started as a small effort to take care of his kids has turned into something much more. A few classmates of mine got together and said, the need after 15 years of us being deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan is so great. And when you think about wounded warriors and combat deaths and post-traumatic stress and depression, the wake, the aftermath that's being left behind that is visited on soldiers and their families is going to be generational in its impact. And how good would it be for us who've all come from this shared experience to kind of come together to help to answer the call? So we started raising money. Our mission is to provide college scholarships for children whose parents made the ultimate sacrifice. And John McHugh is our inspiration. He's kind of our rallying cry. And in the last 2 years, you know, our group has rallied. We've raised $8 million. We've put 170 kids through college or in the process of going through college. So it's a side job for me, but it's one that I'm very, very passionate about. And to be working at a place like the AMB group where giving back is expected of everybody, and whatever your passion is, that's part of your job description. So this is me living up to the core values of our company.
Steve Cannon, as we wrap up, give us a completion date on the stadium.
We're June of next year, on schedule. The last of the big trusses got put up last week, and now it's about removing those cranes. It's going to be cleaning out that inner bowl. You're going to start to see the pace of our construction pick up. So we're going to begin taking over parts of the building in April, May, June timeframe. And then as we shake the building down, go through the punch list that will invariably be part of that, we're looking forward to hosting Atlanta United and Falcons football next fall.
And if anything isn't in place, the right bolt, the right beam, do they turn to you and say, Steve, help? What do we do?
I've got a hard hat, if I have to get up there to place that last bolt, I will. But they don't need me. We've got 1,500 workers on site working three shifts, so it is an impressive construction project in its scale.
You're a Jersey guy. Have you completely given your allegiance now to the Atlanta Falcons?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I was. Being part of this NFL club is interesting, and watching what coach is doing on the field and building that team, it's just great to be part of.
Steve Cannon, CEO of the Arthur Blank family of businesses. Steve, thanks for coming in and taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Rose.